What does it say about this country's court system that domestic assault and child rape cases go unpunished so often in state criminal trial courts, or that so many people are wrongfully imprisoned? Amy Bach, who's both an attorney and a journalist, spent 8 years investigating the wide range of courtroom failures occurring throughout the United States, and she details them in her new book called Ordinary Injustice, How America Holds Court. It's published by Metropolitan Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought Amy Bach to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
You begin with a discussion of a case from Quitman, Mississippi, where a woman was certain her 11-year-old granddaughter had been raped and wanted to know why no one had taken the case seriously. Do we have to know about Quitman County, Mississippi, before we understand what went on?
A little bit. Let me back up and explain that. I went down to Quitman County, Mississippi, for a different reason. I thought that I was going to report on the problem with their public defender system. And my phone was ringing off the hook with people telling me these incredible stories, but I couldn't tell what joined them. So I was confused, and I went to the court clerk, a woman named Miss Wiggs. She has a helmet of white hair and a very plain speaking way. And I said, "What's going on here, Miss Wiggs?" And she said, "You want to know?" And she pointed to a list above her desk of cases that had not been prosecuted. People had been charged with crimes, and they had never been brought before the grand jury. So I said, "Do you mind if I use this list?" And I took it, and I used it as a road map to find out what was going on in this county. I went down dirt roads, and I knocked on trailer doors, and I met all sorts of people, including the grandmother that you mentioned, whose 11-year-old girl had been raped, and she had never, her case had never been properly investigated, but that was just one category of crime. I mean, I met one woman who was beaten under a bridge by her boyfriend with a tire iron while her daughter and niece watched from inside a car. And I tried to figure out, well, why was this case never prosecuted? There are witnesses, and she never went back to live with her boyfriend. And it turned out there hadn't been a domestic violence case prosecuted in that county in 21 years.
Now, Mrs. Wiggs obviously was upset, but nobody else was?
Well, if you knew the right people to ask, there were lots of people who were upset. The victims were upset. But if you went to the judges and you went to the lawyers, they all knew something was going on. And many of them, like one judge, for example, wanted to stand up and say something, that there was a problem with prosecution, but he was afraid that if he was wrong, all of these people would be unhappy with him, and he had to live in this community, so he let it go on as well.
And why had it gotten to that point? And is this something that we only would find in Quitman, Mississippi, or might I find this in various parts of the country?
Well, one of the main problems with what I call ordinary injustice is that no one is keeping track of it. So we don't know how prevalent it is across the country. You know, we keep track of all sorts of things in our society, right? We keep track of the purity of our water supply. For schools, we have all sorts of statistics. What's the teacher-student ratio, for example, or what are the college admin rates? But for courts, we have no idea what kind of cases are brought to court, what kind of cases aren't brought to court. And so we're really pretty much at a loss to know how pervasive this problem is. Prosecutorial discretion in this country is an amazing institution. Prosecutors are accountable to pretty much nobody.
So it's the prosecutor who sets the tone in most situations, not the judges?
That's a very important question. A judge has a lot of power to set the tone. And in some cases, if the prosecutor and the defense attorney aren't doing their jobs, a judge can even take over. There is one court that I talk about in my book where I talk about a judge who's the most popular guy in the whole county. He's somebody who, if you walk the streets with him, it's like you're with a celebrity. People hang out of their car windows to say, "Hi, Hank." His name is Hank Bauer in Troy, New York. And when I met him, he had just been elected to city council president. And just months before, in 2005, he had been kicked off the bench by the State Judicial Commission of New York.
And that didn't affect the voters. They voted for him anyway.
They voted because he was cleaning up Troy, but he did some incredible things. Like,
well, if I were Adam Russell, would I have voted for him?
Well, Adam Russell was a young man who was caught up in a sweep, and he ended up spending merely a few hours in jail. There were some of the worst hours of his life. He had a great lawyer, and he ended up getting out. But by contrast to his case is the case of, you know, a sort of a vagrant where the judge basically pleaded him guilty two times without him even being in court. And the difference between the vagrant and Adam Russell is that Adam had a lawyer who cared about his case.
And he knew somebody in Troy, even though
exactly.
He was an out-of-towner.
Adam Russell was somebody in Troy and the son of somebody in Troy. But the vagrant, the guy who's drinking the 50-cent beers, nobody cares.
So if you are a vagrant or if you, I don't know whether the grandmother in Quitman was black in a county that's run by white people, I'm assuming that does happen in many cases.
Right. That was not the case. She was black, but the county is not run only by black people. Yeah. By white people, excuse me.
Well, what leads a prosecutor to not pursue cases like that? Isn't that what a prosecutor is all about? And isn't that how prosecutors make their reputations, going after people and saying, you know, I sent 150 criminals to jail, people who, and I've made our area safer as a result.
Well, that would be great if that were the case. But in many cases, I think it was the case in Quitman County, Mississippi, prosecutors depend on what I call show trials to show the community that crime is being eradicated. So when a big murder case happens, they go full hog. They'll do anything to prosecute and to go after the facts, the kind of stuff you see on TV in Law and Order where the investigator doesn't let up and doesn't let up. But what the cases that he did put aside were the cases where he had to do the legwork and he thought he couldn't win. The marginal cases or the cases where he thought that the jury, it would be a hard sell. You know, domestic violence is very dicey. People have very mixed emotions on it. So his scorecard was winning. And that's one of the things I talk about in Ordinary Injustice is we need to make a different scorecard where it's not just the big cases that make a sound, but it's also the ones that affect most regular people.
But you also say that professional alliances are a key factor in creating these injustices. You say when professional alliances trump adversarialism, ordinary injustice predominates.
Exactly.
And so in many of these courthouses, everybody's friends with everybody?
Yes. There's a good example of professional alliances in the book. I think the best example is the case of Tom Breen in Chicago. He's a prosecutor and in the 1970s. Today, he's actually a defense lawyer, probably one of the best defense lawyers in Chicago. If I was ever charged with a crime, I would want Tom Breen. And in the 1970s, he prosecuted two 17-year-old boys for raping and murdering a little girl. And then nearly two decades later, he comes forward and says to a friend of his who investigates wrongful convictions, you know what? I think I could have made a mistake. And based on that tip, an investigation's launched. And then 27 years after these two boys, now men, were first convicted, they're set free based on DNA evidence. So I said to Tom Breen, you know, why did you wait so long to say something? And he said this thing that I'll never forget. He said, it's hard to rock the boat when you're in the boat. And that is that kind of collusion that we're talking about. He was very beholden to the investigators and to law enforcement, and it made them sort of form a group blind eye.
Don't they also not want to set a precedent if you start allowing everybody who claims to be innocent to then go back and look at the DNA evidence, and the next thing you know, all sorts of victories that you've had in the past are going to not look so good. I remember a case of a guy who was accused of engaging in satanic murders by his daughter, and for whatever reason, he agreed that he had, even though it was not true. Everybody else in the case was freed, but they didn't want to free him because he had confessed, and that would set a precedent.
Yes, I think by showing a mistake, we in essence bring up all the mistakes of the past. and all the possible mistakes. And you know, and I know as a professional, that we make mistakes every day.
Speak for yourself, Amy.
And we have a feeling sometimes, well, maybe this wasn't right, and we don't want to go there. We don't want to go to the fact that maybe we really could have hurt somebody. So we park it in a place in our mind and don't go back to it. And what he did, which was so courageous, was he brought up that nagging feeling. And the result has been that the people who work with him hate him. Like his former, you would think that they would say, oh, great, you fixed that mistake. Instead, someone he worked with is quoted in the book as saying, he's the most despicable person that I know.
We're seeing a similar situation in today's newspaper where the Texas governor has decided not to allow an investigation to proceed into a possible wrongful execution.
Well, Texas, I mean, has all sorts of problems. The Willingham case, the Todd Willingham case, which, there was a big New Yorker piece about it, and he may actually be the first innocent person who's been put to death, and Texas is going to have to contend with that. There's an investigation going on right now. I really think that we have these enormous problems in the criminal justice system, and you can see them if you sit in court, as I did every day for 8 years, and you can't believe in the sanctity of the death penalty, that you're sure to have the right person. If you really see, if you want to go back to the process, that's what.
And we'll talk about some of those things you saw over those 8 years after we take a little break. My guest is Amy Bach. Her book is Ordinary Injustice, How America Holds Court. It's published by Metropolitan Books. Stay with us. We're back with Amy Bach. Her book, Ordinary Injustice, How America Holds Court, is published by Metropolitan Books. You're both an attorney and a journalist. Which came first for you?
I was a journalist for 5 years before I went to law school. And then I graduated law school from Stanford, and I clerked for a judge in Miami, and then I had a grant from the Nation Institute to write about civil rights, which is how this book began.
So you saw this as going to the courts and seeing how the civil rights is being acted out in various parts of the country? And then you saw something. Well, this is a civil rights story, but not civil rights as we normally think of it, simply in terms of race.
Yeah, I mean, clearly the courts are the greatest civil rights issue, I mean, facing Americans, because so many Americans are affected. 25% of Americans have some sort of a criminal record, which is an astounding statistic. But yet, courts really remain, I think most people would agree, the most unexamined public institution in America.
Well, you say that many lawyers can't see their own role in perpetuating bad behavior.
Mm.
You've described being in a courtroom where the defendants were not consulted, were not allowed to say anything in their defense, in fact, had not even spoken to their lawyers, and they were pled guilty one after another. And the lawyers thought, I guess that was a lawyer who was being provided for them. They didn't see anything wrong in that?
No. And in fact, that was the thing that made me want to write the book. I had gone to Greene County, Georgia in 2001, and I saw a public defender plead 48 people guilty in one day. And you could see in court, you know, one woman starts to cry and says, wait, I didn't realize I was going to jail. Another person says, wait, I don't understand what's happening to me. And so afterwards, I asked the prosecutor and the judge and the defense attorney, how do you think things went today? And everybody said, fine. And what I realized was there were all these smart, committed, hardworking professionals who routinely acted in ways that fell short of what people in their positions were supposed to be doing.
Well, what did they think their job was? If he's a defense attorney, isn't his job to defend the people that he's been assigned?
Exactly. And so to defend the people, you have to know the facts. You have to know the circumstances of the individual case. He didn't know their names. He didn't know their faces. He didn't know anything about their individual circumstances. And that was because there would begin a routinization. Everything had become so routine in that court, and the lapses had become so ongoing that the legal professionals could no longer see their role in these mistakes. And that is ordinary injustice right there, when people can't see their role in the lapses.
So they were just moving the people right through and preventing any kind of a backlog.
Exactly.
But you also write that your book is based on the premise that it takes a community of legal professionals to let a sleeping lawyer sleep.
Yes.
That's because they will not report when a lawyer sleeps, or in some cases judges fall asleep during a case?
Well, to give you an example, that was that day that I was in court. I was sitting there, and it was incredibly hard to hear. And there was this guy sitting next to me, and he was a lawyer. And he said, "Amy, why don't you ask the judge to speak up?" And I said, the man was actually a sort of a famous lawyer. His name is Steve Bright of the Southern Center for Human Rights. And I said, Steve, I'm not going to ask the judge to speak up. This is court, and I wanted to maintain, some sort of, And so he stood up and he said, "Your Honor, would you mind speaking up?" And she ended up calling him before her, and he ends up taking over the courtroom and saying, "Your Honor, please, we're all here today. Please, would you mind speaking up? People are missing their day at work. Their children are left in the care of others. Would you please speak up?" And the whole place broke out. Now, everyone was so excited. "Amen. Thank you so much for speaking out." That was just for asking the judge to speak up. That's how routinized it had become in that courtroom.
But then you say the next day it was just as quiet as it had been before anyone had been asked to speak up. So they just did it because somebody had demanded it,
That's right. And there was this huddle in the beginning of the court, in the court. There was this huddle with the judge and the prosecutor and the defense attorney. That huddle is what my book is about. It's about how professionals, people like me and you, become more attached to people we work with than performing the checks that make the adversarial system work. And you have to understand that this kind of collusion, this kind of groupiness, this huddle is very, very important in most careers. We love teamwork. We love people working together. But when it comes to adversarialism, it's a failure because the entire system is based on a prosecutor and a defense attorney opposing each other to bring out the facts of the case. Through this opposition, there's some sort of synthesis. And that's what's missing in so many courtrooms across America, people really doing their jobs to create this truth.
You say across America, but many of the instances you cite take place in the South. Is it worse in the South?
I have no idea. Because like I said before, we don't have any sort of monitoring system. And it's not true that the book is Chicago, mm-hmm. New York, Mississippi, and then a county in Georgia, which is really sort of a sophisticated place. George Bush's largest fundraiser lives there. George Bush himself has vacationed there several times.
Tell us about the case of Robert E. Serency and how that's significant. That took place in that county, right? In
yes,
Green?
And that's what I was talking about. He was the public defender who pled 48 people guilty in one day. Mm-hmm. And the amazing thing about him was that he really became a poster child for everything that was wrong in Georgia. After I wrote an article about him, and he ended up testifying before the Georgia Commission on Indigent Defense, and he ended up leaving his job. And by a comedy of errors, this man, who really was painted as one of the worst public defenders in Georgia, ends up working for the best public defender's office in the whole state. And he ends up being a fantastic lawyer. So it's really about how we can't make bad apples. We can't make individuals responsible. It's about creating better systems. And it's our job as Americans to create better systems. But right now, we're concerned with healthcare, we're concerned with this and that, and we're not looking at our courts.
How much of this is also the result of bad funding for our courts?
Funding is clearly a serious issue, but it's not the only issue. It doesn't account for the human need for people to group together. You could have a well-funded place and have this kind of collusion.
Well, a listener wanted to know whether you would address the issue of privatized prisons. I don't know if that's really within your purview, but we did have that situation of the corrupt judges in Pennsylvania who were sending kids off to privatized I guess, child, what was it, a youth facilities.
A youth facility and getting a kickback. Now, that is the perfect example of ordinary injustice, and it hasn't been framed that way, and let me explain to you why. Every day in court, people saw, lawyers saw, these kids being sent to prison for nothing crimes. Kids who didn't deserve it, they knew it was going on. They saw kids without lawyers, and yet they said nothing. They didn't stand up. That's what ordinary injustice is. It's this, well, it's not my case. Maybe the kid deserved it. It's the sense that nobody's standing up to say what looks like justice is actually not justice.
And as you said earlier, when people do buck the system, they wind up becoming hated. So I guess the answer is that there's an awful, at this very moment, there are courtrooms all over America where injustices are being performed and nobody's going to say anything about it.
Exactly. You know, there's two really important Supreme Court cases coming up having to do with minors, you know, 13-year-old, 16-year-old, getting life without parole. And these cases, you're going to hear about them in November. They're going to be, it's a big deal. They're already making the front pages. And while this debate is going on, if you look at these cases, you will actually see that the trials they received were terrible. An 8-hour trial in one day, you know, lawyers who don't believe them. If you want to fix these extraordinary problems, if you want to, you know, decrease the number of people in our prisons, if you want to, if you're wondering why are all these innocent people, go look at the ordinary. Go sit in America's courts.
Well, some people would tell you that the Supreme Court is also a place of injustice. Recently, the court decided that a prisoner doesn't have the right to request DNA evidence being checked out if he feels that he was wrongfully imprisoned.
Yeah, I don't understand.
You know, I mean, you're focusing mostly on local courts, state courts, and county courts, but perhaps there is something that has to do with the way law is taught in this country that would lead people to think that, well, rules are rules, and it doesn't really matter whether we're doing something that has any kind of humane aspect to it.
Clearly, what is happening in America's courts is the result of Supreme Court precedent and policy over the years, and we could really use the leadership to change there.
Amy Bach is a member of the New York Bar, has written on law for The Nation, The American Lawyer, and New York Magazine, among other publications. And her latest work is a book called Ordinary Injustice, How America Holds Court. It is published by Metropolitan Books. It got great review in the most recent edition of the New York Review of Books. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. It was great.